Few of us ever get to be living legends. I think it takes, first of all, a certain aura. You have to be a legend, I guess, before you become a living legend. And then you have to go off somewhere where you sort of disappear for a long period of time. I kind of think that's what Ray Palmer did when he quit the Ziff Davis Publishing Company, where he was head of their fiction group. He was editor of Amazing Stories, of Fantastic Adventures, of other fiction magazines they had, when the company decided that they were going to move to New York. Ray began to make other plans. At the same time, I was editor of Flying Magazine, and I didn't want to go to New York any more than Ray did. And together we tried to work out a common venture. And that venture was Fate Magazine. I think Ray mostly contributed the concept, and I contributed the name. And many people have asked me, where did the name Fate come from? And it came from a list of names that move people that had been published in Fortune magazine. And we thought, Fate is one of the words that move people. And you have to understand that we looked upon this as professional publishers, and I, at least, became hooked after we started Fate magazine, and not before. Ray doesn't make many public appearances. He's off in Amherst, Wisconsin, on his farm, with his own private lake, with his own dam, generating his own electricity. And I don't say he's completely self-sufficient, but he achieves a lot more of it than the rest of us. Ray is editor of Search Magazine, Ray Palmer's Forum, and Space World. For many years, he published Flying Saucers, which was a UFO periodical. He has emerged, if I'm correct, as the foremost exponent of the earthly origin of UFOs. He early advocated, and he can correct me again, the two polar regions as the location of hidden saucer bases. Ray created a major sensation in science fiction by publishing the accounts of Richard Shaver, who claimed he had visited the inner earth and discovered a whole new civilization. The Shaver mystery and Ray's subsequent endorsement of inner earth theories created a continuing controversy among UFO enthusiasts, and I may say I've been braced on it several times today by people who say, well, what about this inner earth then? And what about that? What about the people who live inside the earth? It was Ray Palmer who commissioned the early writings of Kenneth Arnold on the 30th anniversary of whose sightings this conference is based. Ladies and gentlemen, Ray Palmer, a legend in his time.
Electromagnetic, among other things. I felt when I first became the editor of Amazing Stories that I wanted to reach the younger people. So I got into the sort of cowboy sort of science fiction, which offended a great many of the people like Heinlein and so on. And although I can say I bought Isaac Asimov's first story, it's the only one he ever sold me, because He didn't want to be associated with the kids that I was reaching. Anyway, about 1943, I got a letter from a man named Richard Shaver, who said he had an ancient alphabet, which was common to all languages, and would I publish it? And I did. And this is, I think, where the UFO first got its start, because I got hundreds of letters from people saying, this alphabet is really unique because I've tried it out in various languages and it really does work, as Shaver said. Well, what Shaver said briefly is that the English language is the origin of all languages, and I think any professional in the audience will tell you that's absolutely wrong, that English is a derivative of all of the languages that preceded it, from the Sanskrit on. Well, I tried it out myself, and I tried it among the staff of Zip Davis, and they were very amazed. A reporter came over from the Chicago Tribune, and he tried different words on me and said, use the alphabet and decipher them. Well, he used languages that I'd never heard of before, and I deciphered them correctly. And he says, you know what you're doing? You're reading my mind. Well, I wasn't reading his mind. I was using Shaver's alphabet. If I had been reading his mind, I would have considered it to be an even more amazing thing than finding an alphabet, which was a common denominator to all languages. So I wrote Shaver and I asked him where he got the language. And that's where I got the surprise of my life. The letter he sent back was 11,000 words long. It was called A Warning to Future Man. And it claimed that Mr. Shaver had spent 8 years in an underground civilization in the caves, and that there he had met two types of people. One were the Dero. Now, D is a symbol for disintegration or destructive, and Ro is a shortening of the word robot or robotic. So that a Dero is a robotically controlled human being. Conversely, a Tero, is, which T was just integrative, and you can compare it to the cross of Christianity if you want to, but it is constructive, and persons guided by T are robotically controlled for good. Well, he said that he had spent 8 years down in the caves with these people. And his warning to a future man was what these people had told him about how it came to be that they were down there. It seems that around 12,000 years ago, the Earth was bombarded by radiation from a solar flare of great magnitude, and life on the surface became impossible because of radioactivity. So the first thing they did was retreat underground in vast cities that they built with their tremendous science. But it was necessary to use surface air and water, and gradually these underground cities became contaminated, so the only answer was that they had to flee this planet. So they built spaceships, and the privileged ones were able to leave, but the bulk of the population was abandoned, and they were termed in by Shaver the abandoned Dero. Now these were the people who, among whom he says he lived for 8 years. These people had access to the tremendous scientific machines that were left by this super civilization that left the Earth. And they were using them to detrimental purposes because their minds had been affected by the radioactives, and their thought was negative instead of positive. The best example I can give you of that is the Boy Scout who said to the old lady, I'm going to take you across the street. And which his intent was good, but by the time he got to the middle of the street, the radioactives in his mind had made the thought turn around and become evil, and he pushed the old lady under a truck. Now that's the type of thinking that goes on, says Shaver, in the caves. So I didn't think it was a very good environment, and I didn't think much of the people. But many of my readers, in reading the stories, began to tell me, as a matter of fact, when we published the first story, we got 50,000 letters saying that not only was Shaver telling the truth, but thousands of them claimed to have also been in the caves, and they confirmed his story. Well, Mr. Ziff, who read the first story, called me into his office, and he said, Ray, these are my magazines. I'm not going to allow you to ruin them. You call this story a true story, and you know it isn't. And he says, it's going to destroy our circulation. So I said, Mr. Ziff, will you allow me to ask my staff to bring in the letters that we've received on this story? Well, it took 7 or 8 people to bring them in, and there was a tremendous pile on the floor in front of Mr. Ziff. And he said to me, Ray, the only thing that I'm disappointed in is why didn't you promote this thing the way it deserved? Well, I did promote it over the next 4 years, and we raised the circulation of Amazing to 185,000 from a beginning of around 75,000, and we held that. But I'm going to tell you something about the way we raised that circulation, which is another thing that got me more and more convinced that Shaver really had something. This was during the war, and Ziff Davis was short of paper. And the pulp magazines, with circulations up near a total of 8 million with 9 or 10 titles, had sufficient paper to carry Ziff Davis publications far in advance on the quota system of any other publisher in the country. Well, Mr. Fuller's magazine, Flying, was one of those magazines, and it needed paper. So they stole the paper from me. They stole the paper for Popular Photography. And they had enough magazines to flood the newsstands and became one of the leading publishers in the country simply because they had paper, all due to Mr. Shaver. And here's how Shaver got the paper. I told him we didn't have the paper because of the war, so we couldn't print extra copies of Amazing Stories. And he said, no problem. I'll just contact the Darrow. He says, what's the name of your circulation manager? I said, Mr. Strong. He says, okay, Mr. Strong will give you the paper. And the Darrow somehow put the thought in Mr. Strong's mind that this particular issue, we ought to come out with 50,000 extra copies of Amazing Stories. When Mr. Davis heard of this, he was furious because we were harming Flying and Popular Photography. And he said, Ray, you know these cock and bull stories are not going to sell. So I said, well, you call Mr. Strong and see what the circulation reports are. And he called Mr. Strong, and Mr. Strong said, you know, we have received an order from the American News Company for 100,000 additional copies of this magazine because they had sold it out. And Mr. Davis, without altering his tone of voice in mid-sentence, said in effect, Ray, you're ruining my magazine, but I don't understand why you haven't given it the proper promotion. He says, let's get behind this thing, Ray. You're missing a great opportunity. Now, how could I tell Mr. Davis that the reason we had all this paper was because a Darrow down in a cave had directed a Telog ray on Mr. Strong and made him take the paper back from Mr. Fuller. But I became interested in Mr. Shaver now because when you produce a phenomena like that, you're not talking about an ordinary person. So I went to Pennsylvania to visit Mr. Shaver. And I found out that he was a very simple man. He was a hell of a good chess player. I never was able to beat him. And certainly nothing wrong with him mentally. And while I was there, we talked until about 2 o'clock in the morning. Then he took me up to my bedroom. And it turned out it was a bedroom which I had to go through his bedroom. And there was no other way out. So I was stuck in there. Well, his wife had to go out and feed the numerous animals and chickens that they had. And about at 3 o'clock, she came back up. But he went to bed at 2 along with me in his bedroom. And I left the door ajar because he told me about all these voices that talked to him, and I wanted to hear them. And to my utter amazement, I did. Mr. Shaver apparently went into a trance. That's what I would call it. And I heard 5 voices speaking, a young child and two women and 2 adults. And the subject of their conversation was that 4 miles down and 4 miles away, somebody had been torn into 4 quarters by horses that afternoon, and this was a very terrible thing and it shouldn't be allowed to happen. Now, I agreed heartily, so I said, yes, I agree, this shouldn't happen. And instantly the voices changed, and the child's voice says, pay no attention to him, he's a jerk. And then they began talking in a language I didn't understand. But later on, they reverted back to English, and they went through the same rigmarole again. And I said, let me in on this. What's it all about? And again, I was called a jerk. Well, after an hour, Mrs. Shaver came upstairs, and the voices ceased instantly. And I might add that when these voices were talking, sometimes all 5 would be talking at once. Now, if this was ventriloquism or it was Shaver's vocal cords doing it. It was quite a stunt. Well, they stopped instantly when Mrs. Shaver came up, and I went to sleep, and that was it for the rest of the night. When I got up in the morning, Mr. Shaver asked me how I slept. And I didn't want to spoil my act, and I wanted to stay a few more days, so I said I slept fine. And he says, I thought you would because I told them not to make a fuss while you're here. And I said, for Pete's sake, Dick, let them make all the fuss they want. The next night I went to bed and I slept like a rock, which I never do. And I found out no more as far as the voices are concerned, except that I was convinced Mr. Shaver was hearing real voices. Well, I went back to Chicago and we began running Shaver's stories. And as the Shaver mystery progressed, he told me about the science that was occurring in the caves. And here I'm going to get to the flying saucers and the relationship of science fiction to flying saucers. He told me that in the caves, they had tunnels connecting the various caves, tunnels sometimes hundreds of miles long, crisscrossing the entire United States, and as a matter of fact, the whole world. And these tortuous, curved caves with their many obstructions and rough walls were traversed by what he called a rollat. A rollat is a vehicle that is robotically controlled. In other words, operates without a pilot. And they floated about a foot off the floor of the cave tunnels. And they traveled about 1,500 miles an hour. And when they'd reach a turn in the tunnel, they would make this turn at 1,500 miles an hour. And I couldn't understand why even the derelicts weren't crushed against the walls of their craft. Well, it was about that time that Mr. Arnold made his sighting. And Shaver called me up and he says, you see, I told you they'd travel that way. And he says, they do come out on the surface and they finally have come out. He says, you note the peculiar method that they traveled, which is very similar to the rockets that we have today, which the Russians are so concerned with because they follow the contour of the surface of the Earth. Perhaps 50 to 100 feet above it, and when they get to a tree, they zip right over it, and they don't contact and wreck themselves. Well, you can understand why Kenneth Arnold was confused at the way these things have traveled. To Mr. Shaver, it was triumph itself. I had the proof right there in my hands, but at the same time, I also had another proof, and it was a very disturbing one. I got a letter from a nurse. Who was a nurse in the Ypsilanti State Hospital for the Insane in Ypsilanti, Michigan. She said, I know Mr. Shaver very well because I was his nurse during the 8 years in which he was incarcerated. You can imagine my consternation at this point. I'm dealing with a madman. I'm dealing with a schizophrenic, with a paranoid person who has spent 8 years in a catatonic state, living in a world in his own imagination. Now, how can I go on with the Shaver mystery as treating it as a reality unless I assume that what is happening to Mr. Shaver is the very same thing that is happening to many of you out there when you say you are contactees or when you hear voices? I asked my readers to report to me what the voices said, and I asked how many of them heard voices, and by using the formula that advertisers use to tell how many people are reading their magazine so they can sell an ad on that basis and know what to charge, I concluded that there were 20 million people in this country who heard voices. So I contacted about 100 of them, and I asked them to report to me weekly what the voices said. And to my utter amazement, I would get dozens of reports on the same day of people who had heard the voices from people widely scattered all over the country who heard the voices say identical words. Now, if Mr. Shaver was a schizophrenic and the voices were in his own mind and all of these other 100 people were schizophrenics, the voices would be saying different things, if I am correct in what psychiatry believes about it. So then I had to conclude that not only wasn't Shaver a psychopath, but that he was rehearing voices which were real. And what else could I conclude that they must be in the caves that he's talking about? Although by then I had decided they weren't in caves. I had come across a book called Owaspe. In Owaspe, which deals with the history of the Earth for the past 79,000 years and the history of the heavens for the same period, it speaks of the spirits of the dead floating upward to various levels or plateaus, depending on their development. And between these plateaus, the Aetherians would construct what they called roadways and travel between the plateaus. Along these roadways was by vehicles exactly similar to the things that Mr. Shaver described as traversing the tunnels and Mr. Arnold said he saw along the Cascade Ranges. And they made these same peculiar fluttering motions. Now I'm beginning to put two and two together. We're not talking about two different things. We're talking about a psychic phenomena and yet a real physical phenomena, because Kenneth Arnold is very adamant when he says that these were machines. And I think Stan Friedman will say the same thing. I thought Mr. Hynek would say the same thing, but to my astonishment, he has converted himself almost entirely to the psychic phenomena in regard to flying saucers. Now, I want to get into into the diversion that the clever Mr. Fuller knows I will get into. I want to say that I want to retitle this speech, The Stymie Factor. Well, Kenneth Arnold and I are very familiar with the Stymie Factor, and this is the element of ridicule. I think this is the thing which Arnold and I have lived with for 30 years, and which is the reason I have not appeared in public in a group such as this. Because when I get to the things I'm about to touch upon, I know that among you, at least 50% will get a glazed look in your eyes. Some of you will have to go to the bathroom, and you will leave, and you will not come back. Now, I made a speech like this once before, and you can believe that I'm saying a factual thing or an allegorical thing if you wish. But in the midpoint of my speech, I found that I was entirely alone. You know that when you are in the bathroom singing, how wonderful you sound. Well, I heard my voice reverberating from the walls, and it sounded wonderful. And I talked for 2 hours. And after I got through, I stood up and gave myself a standing ovation for 10 minutes. But the stymie factor is what I really want to talk about now. And it has stymied every one of you, I'm sure. My first real encounter with the stymie effect was when I stood on a stage similar to this in Chicago around 1950, and I debated the flying saucers with Willie Ley. And I brought to this debate what I thought was as good evidence as we had at that time. And I was very sincere about taking the positive side of this debate. And Mr. Ley asked me a question. He said, "How do the flying saucers fly?" And I thought, you've just given me the opening I want, because I've just told you about the different ways they fly in Shaver's tunnels, in Owosky's roadways in the atmosphere, and in Kenneth Arnold's sighting over the Cascades. They fly like this. But Mr. Ley didn't give me an opportunity to describe it. He withdrew from his pocket, having come very prepared for the debate, a saucer, minus a cup, of course, and he tossed it into the air and fell to the stage with a crash and broke into 100 pieces. And there were 2,000 people out there laughing. And there was no possibility of me continuing effectively in my end of the debate. So I think I did a very unworthwhile thing then. I'm not really proud of it. I turned around in my thoughts and I did all I could to help Mr. Ley demolish me. Just a month or so ago, one of the fan magazines, maybe the editor is here and guilty of it, said that in 1950 or so, Willie Ley demolished Ray Palmer on the debate stand, and he did. And that is why it happened, because I was so stymied, so frustrated by the ridicule that I decided it was not worth my time to waste it on those 2,000 people who had a good laugh. And Arnold, I think, can tell you the very same thing. If he doesn't stick to his nuts and bolts, he'll get the same glazing over and the same desire to go to the bathroom. Well, I've been in this Shaver, in this saucer thing longer than anybody. I predate Mr. Arnold by 3 years because I knew about the flying saucers from Mr. Shaver. This is my 33rd anniversary. Well, fans began to feud about the Shaver mystery and about the flying saucers And it even got 8 pages in a May issue of Life magazine in 1952, all of which was of the kind of thing I call the stymie factor. We were being ridiculed. Well, now I want to go back in time a little bit, because I'm not going to be very coherent in terminology and chronology in this thing. But I want to go back to the Maury Island thing, which Mr. Arnold is going to talk about tomorrow. And I'm going to let him tell you all about it. I'm not going to go into any great details. But Harold Dahl sent me a package of fragments, he said, came from a flying saucer that had crashed, or at least dumped some of its fragments on his boat in Tacoma Harbor, killing his cat or dog, we've never decided which, injuring his son, and depositing much of this material on Maury Island. And he sent me a box of these fragments. Now, I had the fragments analyzed by U.S. Steel and by Northwestern University and by the University of Wisconsin. And they said, in their opinion, it was slag from a smelter. But there was one peculiarity which interested them. One of the components was calcium. And calcium burns off at 850 degrees. And they all subjected this material to temperatures in excess of 2,500 degrees, and the calcium remained fixed in the metal. Now, you may not consider this significant, but it is extremely significant in several different aspects. If we are going to go into space, it is necessary to shield our astronauts from radiation. And calcium has an affinity for radioactive particles like strontium-90 and various things, and it is a good shield for cosmic radiation. It is also a good shield for radiation from atomic power plants. They wanted to know how the calcium was retained in this metal, and of course, I couldn't tell them. And I was doubtful of whether I could tell them where I got the material because of the stymie factor. All I would have to do is say I got them from a flying saucer, and we're off on a flying saucer right there. At least I would be. So I didn't tell them how. I just said these fragments had been sent to me, and I didn't know their origin. Well, when Mr. Arnold was at Maury Island, or at Tacoma, it happened that he became so disturbed at what was going on, including Men in Black, and he called me up and said he wanted to return the $500 I'd given him for expenses and get out of there because he didn't like what was happening. And he said to me, and this happened to be on my birthday, and he interrupted my birthday party, he said, "The Davidson and Brown are going to fly back to San Francisco with the fragments, which were furnished by Colonel Sanders, and also with the fragments which I had given to Arnold." And I said to Arnold, "Please don't let these men fly back with these fragments, because I doubt if they'll reach their destination alive." Well, Mr. Arnold wasn't prepared to go that far. He said, "Just fragments of slag, and they may or may not be from a flying saucer. I don't know." Well, as you know, this B-25 crashed against a mountain near Kelso, Washington. One of the occupants of the plane was a hitchhiker who had been taken along. It's traditional that if a military man is present and wants to go someplace, a military craft is going there, they take him along. Well, as they neared Kelso, Washington, they made these two hitchhikers strap on parachutes and they simply dumped them. And one of them broke his leg and wound up in the Kelso hospital. This man later told a reporter from the Post Intelligencer, Seattle Intelligencer, that what had happened is one of the engines had burst into flame. And the reason it had burst into flame, because the B-25 had been fired upon by a P-51. Now here's where I'm not only going to get into the stymie factor, I'm going to get into investigations with the CIA and the FBI and Lord knows who else. So all I can say is that this hitchhiker may or may not have been telling the truth. But it is true that he is not available today, nor is the reporter who got the story from him. And neither is Davidson or Brown available, because they were dead, as I predicted. Arnold called back that night and he told me in a very shaken voice that these two men were dead and that he wished he had listened to me. And I said, "Ken, don't fly your own plane back." Well, he said, "I know how to fly and I'm not worried about it." And when he tells you tomorrow night about how he crashed his plane, I think you'll understand how I felt when I heard that he had crashed. And here's where I want to get more into the psychic angle of ufology. I've always been able to do these things myself. And the ability to know things without knowing how I know them is still a mystery to me. And I don't really know how I knew that this plane was going to crash, but it did. And I had recourse then to go back to Mr. Shaver, and I talked very seriously to him, and he says, it's very simple, he says. The Darrow, of course, have these wonderful telepathic machines, and they told you these things. They put a ray on your brain, and they give you this information, and that's how it all happens. And so since I didn't believe that Shaver was really contacting little people underground, but to put it bluntly, astral entities located somewhere in our atmosphere, I was again confronted with the stymie factor, both in science fiction and in ufology. And you can hardly blame me for wanting to retire to South Sea Islands or something. Anyway, I'm going to look at my notes here and see what else I'm going to deviate on. One of the things that happened when this Maury Island incident occurred was that Colonel Ruppelt wrote a book for Project Blue Book and said that the whole thing was a hoax and that these two men were died on my account. Well, they probably did if the information that I furnished Mr. Arnold is the cause of their death, but I don't think so. I think that somehow it was necessary that that the flying saucers not be substantiated in any way. Mr. Arnold will tell you of his frustrations in that respect and of the mess the newspapers made of every story he tried to give them. Well, now I'm going to go back to OWASPE. I'm going to talk about these plateaus and roadways and continents in the sky. I read the Chicago Tribune one morning, and I read about a man named Grote Reber who lived in Wheaton, Illinois. And he had built a radar receiver in his backyard. It was a 30-foot disc made out of 24-gauge sheet metal. And it rotated north and south on 15-foot concrete pylons. And he said that he was receiving nightly intelligent messages from space. And they even reproduced some of the dot-dash messages that he was receiving in the paper. I immediately went out to see him, but I was, of course, too late. Like Arnold, Mr. Reber had been deluged by curiosity seekers, newspaper reporters, and what have you. And he wasn't seeing anybody else, so he wasn't going to talk to me. So I went around to the rear yard, and I looked at his receiver. And if he was getting signals from outer space, as he claimed, this machine could only be rotated in a north-south direction. And if the signals were located very far away, you can understand that he could not keep them in focus more than a few seconds. This didn't hold true with his statement that he recorded them at 8-hour sessions each night. So I felt that Mr. Grote Reber was not telling the truth. And I felt that on my own reasoning power, that if he was listening to anything for that period of time, it had to be located very close. Now, I'm going to mention Stanton Friedman here, and I'm not going to say it in any derogatory sense, because I admire the man. But he is convinced that the flying saucers are extraterrestrial. And I only want to ask this little simple question. How extra? We know that Terra is the name of the Earth. It is the ancient name of the Earth. It refers to the surface of the Earth. Anything extraterrestrial is off the surface of the Earth. And I want to make the range of extra from, say, 6 inches to 100 miles. We can go to 50,000 if we want to, but even at 50,000 we run across this difficulty that Grote Reber could not have focused long enough to get the messages in the period of time he stated. So I concluded that his intelligent messages were coming from an area above Wheaton, Illinois, which, like our satellites, was fixed in position and only about 100 miles up. Well, I discovered then that Mr. Rui Reaver was a member of the Wheaton Spiritualist Society, or at least that was something like the title. And here again I was stymied. I had something hot in my hands and I couldn't do anything with it, because you can't believe a spiritualist, can you? Specifically when you're talking about such things as intelligent messages from space or flying saucers or the type of hardware that Mr. Friedman talks about. So, again, we have an introduction into the flying saucer mystery of the psychic, because I felt that Mr. Reber said that his messages came from outer space, because how do you say that you are getting messages from 100 miles up when any fool can see there's nothing there? And I then went back to OWASPE and I found many instances where it was claimed that the drudges, which is a significant word compared to shavers, darrows, were the lower type of astral beings in OWASPE, who live anywhere from 6 inches up extraterrestrial to 100 miles, and that they were the source of these messages. And I found in OWASPE numerous references to these people obsessing or possessing human beings, talking to them, and I was then reminded of the 20 million people that I just found were capable of hearing voices, and I no longer could call schizophrenics. So I'm once more confronted with a stymie factor, which is insurmountable. And I would have dropped the whole thing right there, because I'm not going to get anywhere with it, until the U.S. government went to Hawaii, built a $10 million receiver, and placed Mr. Groat Reaver in charge. He is still there. They say he is listening to hissing noises from distant galaxies, which may have been of some astronomical and scientific and maybe physical significance. I don't know. I have found that it is of no use to me, and I'm sure it's of no use to you, and I'm willing to drop it at that. Except for one thing, I don't believe for a minute that Mr. Reber is not listening to the same things he was listening to in Wheaton, Illinois. Now, I'm reminded of Robert Oppenheimer, who was asked to build a hydrogen bomb. He said, "We can't do it, and I won't do it. If I could do it, it's too dangerous. We might set the atmosphere afire and destroy the Earth." And for that, he was castigated and called a communist, and his clearance was rejected. And you all know what happened to Mr. Oppenheimer. But then along comes Edward Teller, and he lays on the table the complete design of how to build a hydrogen bomb. And in my imagination, which is very, very fertile, I put together two and two, and I say, Groat Reaver told him. And Groat Reaver got it from listening in on this super civilization that exists 100 miles up. The very same one that Mr. Shaver misinterprets as being underground.